So if you look at the handout there, there's a couple of pages of just text that looks like, you know, things like who wrote it, when was it written, what was the purpose for it being written, and then that gets you to the third page. And that mine are not front and back, so it's your second page, the front of it, where it says structure and content. You see that? That's where I've broken it down. Now, these are the units of thought that I would break 1 John into, you know, the smaller units, and that's how we'll cover it. So we might do the prologue, where he focuses on Jesus as the Word of Life. That's 1:1-4. Then God is light, walk in him. We'll see, but that would be best case. We get through that tonight. And then you can kind of see where we're going the rest of the study. And then at the very end of that handout, the last page, section 11. So I've broken it into 11 sections. And for, you know, 1 John's not that long, so these sections are bite-sized. The last section, 5:14-21. Now that's 1 John. That's the end of 1 John. Then I just outline 2 and 3 John. So the study includes 2 and 3 John. We probably won't do too much, but they're very brief anyway. They're both one chapter. We'll do a little bit with 2 and 3 John at the end. So that's kind of where we're going. So let's start back to the front. And I've got a little introduction there. Just to say that there's much about the audience that's receiving 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John similar to us today. This letter is about giving people certainty in the midst of grave uncertainty. There is some sort of false teaching that's grown up in the church, and it's somehow related to a theology that says Jesus couldn't really fully be God and be a human being. Some people say that Gnosticism, sort of the heresy that's working on the other side of the letter, but I doubt that it's Gnosticism. That's something that comes along a little bit later. I think that's too specific. I just think it's maybe a false teaching that's related to what becomes Gnosticism, and lots of people held some view that there was this separation between the material world, which was evil, and the body, which is evil, and the spirit realm, which is what is good, the heavenlies, you know, between heaven and earth, sort of seeing this hard division between heaven and earth, and earth and everything that is physical and everything that is matter is evil and is infused with evil. And the goal is to break free of this evil material world and then get to the world of the spirit. If you've studied philosophy, somebody like Platonic dualism would echo, you could hear it in this. So what's happened, it's not that this is just a problem outside the church that the church is having to deal with. No. This is an internal problem. And that's the gravest problem for the church. The church for 2,000 years has only grown stronger when it faces challenge from the outside. It's internal problems that are the most concerning for the people of God. And we've had them over the last year. Now, I'm talking broadly. There's been a lot of division in just Southern Baptist churches over the last year. And I know this because I have a lot of friends that are pastors, and I was interim at Waterloo Road. Now, they didn't have a lot of problems, but I'm talking about when the COVID problem hit and the leadership of churches were having to decide, how are we going to deal with this? Are we going to go online only? Are we going to ask people to wear masks? Are we going to demand that they wear masks? Are we going to change the schedule so that we can spread people out more? All those kinds of questions that were hard questions that pastors and other leaders were dealing with. Almost any decision you made, somebody didn't like it. And I know this because I got included in email chains where we'd gone completely online for about 8 weeks, including Easter. So I'm just doing my videos in Shawnee and hidden sin, and they were playing them on Sunday morning, and I watched them because people would ask questions or comments on the side, and they wanted me there to comment, if anybody did. But there was lots of internal questions about the way it was being handled, and it didn't matter what decision you made. There were going to be people who didn't like the way you were handling it. And lots of pastors I've talked to, they've struggled with the internal conflicts that have come about on the questions of how to deal with COVID. There's been political upheaval that you just can't keep on the outside of the church's walls. People have strong political beliefs, and when the world seems to be sort of melting down politically around us, you just can't say, nope, that's got to stay out there. And all you need is a little social media to know that. And to see how brothers and sisters can, what I fear, really put their Christian witness in peril by the kind of comments they make back and forth. And I'm not just so much talking about just making comments. I'm talking about fighting with your brothers and sisters on social media. And I just, and I won't do it. And I see it and I want to say almost a message to them, don't do that. I know you feel strongly about that, but don't air that out on social media. Maybe go talk to somebody if you need to. But we've had upheaval that if you trace it back, it has to do with what's going on politically in the United States. Am I wrong about that? Just checking. Y'all stopped amening me on that one. Then there's been some Southern Baptists have had some issues often related to black and white, ethnic, racial tensions, critical race theory. If I say a word like that, you may hear, and I see Southern Baptists going at it on social media over those issues, and I want to say the same thing. Don't do that here on your Twitter account or your Facebook account. Don't do that here. And to this church's credit, I don't see your leadership doing that. But I see a lot of it. And it's just symptomatic of lots of internal conflict. So what do we need? We need a sense of what is true. We need a sense of assurance and certainty in the midst of uncertain times. And that's precisely what 1 John mainly. And 2 and 3 John they're just so short. But 1 John is really intended to give certainty believers because of internal conflicts in the churches, I think, in Asia Minor, Ephesus, in and around Ephesus. And it's all about assurance and certainty. Over and over and over in every chapter, we're going to hear the language of, we know, we know, we know. Or, this happened so that you can have confidence in the day of judgment. That you can have confidence in prayer. It's just so much about giving certainty in the midst of uncertainty, helping us know what is true in a world of fake news. Now, I don't mean that as a political statement. I'm talking, that's not a shot at it. I don't want you to get up and walk out on me now. But just when people are asking, the question used to be, what is true? And that's still the question, but now the question is also, who can I trust to tell me the truth? And when you find yourself in that kind of situation, I can't think of a better letter to read than 1 John. And you might say, well, all those questions are political, and they're the general health questions, and they're but so much comes back to theology. What you think matters, what your theology is matters. And often when we find ourselves in these times, we need to be assured theologically. We need to be brought back to what is true theologically. And that often has implications for our politics and our understanding of healthcare, our health and how we should take care of ourselves and whatever else might be going on in the world. So, What an introduction. Now, I thought I'd do something here that you might not think about things like this. These are the things I get to think about. This is what I get to do. I teach these things at OBU, and I get to talk about them with you. The canon. I'm talking about the 27 books that make up the New Testament, the New Testament canon. It matters the way the books of the New Testament are structured. It makes a difference the way we read them, the way they're put together. And I think it's something we should think more about. Just look at the way the early Christians, I think, guided by God's providence, put these documents together, the very order in which we find them, and how they balance one another so beautifully. So it's not just a question of what's in the New Testament, it's the way that these books have been structured and put together by the early Christians under God's guidance. So if you think about it, I think we get some enlightenment about how we ought to think about these books. So where do we start? The New Testament canon begins with four Gospels. You're thinking, duh. But you begin with four Gospels, and what are the Gospels? They are biographies of Jesus. There is no question what they are. They are stories about the birth, in the case of Matthew and Luke, but in the case of all four of them, about the public ministry, the teachings, ultimately the journey to Jerusalem, the death, the resurrection of Jesus, and in the case of Luke, his ascension. So you get the biographies of Jesus. They tell us the story about Jesus. That's where our canon begins. Can you imagine if the next book in the canon was Romans? So where would you end? You'd end with Jesus, you know, going up, ascending into the clouds, telling his people to go wait in Jerusalem. That'd be the end of the Gospels. And then suddenly Paul is writing a letter to the Romans? It would beg the question, well, who's this guy Paul? And where'd these churches come from? And so what is the bridge between the biographies of Jesus and the letters? The book of Acts, which opens with Jesus still with his disciples before the ascension, and him giving them more instructions, and him telling them to go to Jerusalem and wait for the promise of the Father. And then chapter 2, the Spirit comes at Pentecost, and the church is born. And the rest of Acts is the story of the movement of the gospel out in Jerusalem, finally outside of Jerusalem to Judea and Samaria, and ultimately it tells the story primarily through Paul in chapters 13 to 28 of the gospel to the end of the earth. Rome. Where does Acts end? With Paul in Rome still preaching the gospel. Now, he's had from about 47... that's the beginning of his missionary journeys, to about 62. He's had that period of time to be establishing churches in places like Galatia and Ephesus and Thessalonica and Corinth. And he established the churches in most of those cities, not all of them. But the book of Acts tells us about how the church begins at Pentecost, about Paul and other missionaries spreading the gospel throughout the Roman world. So that when we get to the end of Acts, that becomes the bridge then to Romans. And now we begin the collection of the letters in the New Testament. And that begins with Paul's letters. Now here's where it gets interesting to me. Think about Paul's writings in the New Testament. Okay? If I said, how many letters did Paul definitely write? You got an off-the-top number? If you said 13 or 14, I give you credit for either answer. The question is Hebrews. Definitely 13 that bear his name, right? 13 letters. How many letters did he write to churches? Did I hear 9? See, I give you credit for 9, but 2 churches have 2 letters written to them. So it's actually 7. There's 9 letters to churches, but Thessalonica has 2 and Corinth has 2. So it's actually 7 churches. Paul writes a letter to 7 churches, right? Rome, Corinth, Galatia, Ephesus, Philippians, or Philippi, Thessalonica, and who'd I miss? What'd I miss? Did I not say Rome to start? A Colossae. I left off Colossae. See? All right. I give me a B. You get an A. So there's seven. Paul writes a letter to seven churches. Now he writes four letters to individuals. 1 and 2 Timothy, Titus, Philemon. So you've got these 13 letters, seven to seven churches, four individuals. And how do you get the order, Romans to Philemon? What do you notice? What's true about, just contrast Romans and the letter to Philemon. One's really long and one's the shortest. Ah, they're ordered by length, from longest to shortest. And that just so happens to break down beautifully letters to churches, letters to individuals. Now, I would suggest including Hebrews as a number 14. I don't think Paul wrote Hebrews. But I do think it belongs with Paul's collection. It doesn't say who wrote it. But in the early church, it got grouped together with Paul. Not necessarily that Paul himself wrote it, but that it reflected Paul's thinking and theology. So if you do include, and I've put this in the handout. You can read what I've written there whenever, some other time. We didn't just get a whole New Testament 27 letters that, like, you know, Jesus handed to the early Christians. These letters were written over a period of about 50 years, and then there was the process of which letters would be included, and then what the order, and it was quite a process. But when they finally came together, they ordered them longest to shortest. But in P46, now that's one of our earliest collections of Paul's writings. It's a papyrus codex. It looks like a book, but the writings are on papyrus, which is our early form of paper. You take the stalk out of a papyrus plant, and you shave it, and you shave it, and you shave it, and then you mash it together like this until it's thick enough to hold ink. And that's what the earliest documents would have been written on. So we have a collection probably the end of the second century where you actually have, it's the earliest manuscript we have of Paul's letters collected together, and guess what was standing right next to Romans? Hebrews. That's the earliest collection we have. Now, that's where it would belong, up there at the front, you know, with the longer letters. But, and I don't think that necessarily means Paul wrote it. I'm not making that argument tonight. But I do think it reflects Paul's teaching, Paul's theology, and certainly would have been written by somebody who was a co-worker of Paul. Okay, we're still talking about the canon now. How many letters to churches? Not the double letter, just seven different churches he writes a letter to. Now, he writes two letters to two of them, but seven, right? How many total letters then if you include Hebrews? 14. Now that's Paul's writings, and we get the churches he visited and established that you find out about in the book of Acts, and now we get letters to those churches, and we find out what's going on in Christianity between the period of about 50 to probably 62 or something like that. Then what's next in the canon? After Hebrews, we get a collection of guess how many letters? Seven. And they're called the general letters or the Catholic epistles. Not Catholic having anything to do with the Catholic Church. Catholic from the word means according to the whole, and it's just a word that you could translate as universal. Here's a collection of seven letters that are written to very broad audiences. Now, how's that different than Paul's writings? His are very specific. To specific churches and even to specific individuals. But how about James? To the 12 tribes who are scattered. Well, when James is writing that letter, the 12 tribes don't even exist. The 12 tribes of Israel no longer exist as some sort of physical, logistical entity. It couldn't be a more broad way of addressing. You come to 1 Peter, it's to the elect chosen, and he names five provinces. It's an enormous area. Look at 1 John. Go ahead and open your Bibles. 38 minutes in, he finally tells us to open our Bibles. Open your Bibles and look at 1 John and tell me who 1 John is addressed to. My dear children. Yeah, he says over and over again, my dear children. But could that be more broad? It means he's probably writing to believers somewhere. So now you get this collection of seven letters, not written to churches, but seven letters. Now think about now, we had seven letters to churches that Paul wrote, 14 total. Now we get seven letters called the Catholic epistles that are different than Paul's letters. They're not as specific, but there's something else that's different about them. And it's a matter of emphasis. Paul's writings emphasize a very important aspect of our theology. A person is not justified by works of the law, but by faith in Christ Jesus. That sound familiar? I mean, Paul hammers faith and faith alone. Is that all you need to know about living the Christian life? Isn't there something about obedience? I mean, is it just express faith and then you're free to live however you want? Is that the kind of freedom we have in Christ? Isn't there responsibility? Isn't there an expectation of obedience? Not to get in, but as the character, as sort of the character of genuine faith. It will live a certain way. It will be obedient to God's commands. We will not glory in sin. We will not be able to live habitually sinners. Habitually committing the same sins over and over. Those aren't character traits of genuine faith. Well, now, I'm not saying Paul doesn't talk about the importance of what you do after faith, but he certainly emphasizes faith. Now you look at these, what I'm calling the general letters or the Catholic letters, and you look where they emphasize. Yes, they don't contradict Paul. Faith is still faith, and faith is the only way in. But think about the emphasis in these general letters. How about James? What good is it if you claim to have faith, but you have no works? Can that faith save you? That's James 2:14. And what's that caused? Man, that caused Martin Luther to move James to the back of his Luther Bible. Because he said, well, that doesn't look much like Paul's justification by faith. I'm going to move that to the back. It's a right straw epistle, he says. Now, I completely disagree with that, with Luther on that. Arrogant of me, isn't it, to want to disagree with Martin Luther? But I think he was misreading that. And I don't think Paul would have any trouble at all with what James says in James 2:14. The truth is, that kind of faith that has no works can't save you because it's not genuine faith. Can genuine faith save you? Absolutely. It's the only thing. But genuine faith will produce fruit. It's just the nature of it. And depending on what the situation is you're writing to, you might emphasize one side of that more than the other side. You understand what I'm saying? Well, the general letters keep coming back to this issue of how we ought to live as people of faith. And I've got a quote I've got 1 John 2:6. It's at the bottom of the page. If your pagination is like mine, near the bottom of the first page, there's a sentence that starts, while Paul's writings focus on faith alone as the basis of salvation, the letters of John and the other Catholic letters focus on practicing obedience and following God's way. As John declares, and this is 1 John 2:6, The one who claims to abide in him ought to walk just as he walked. Now, this whole discussion, I'm trying to emphasize to you the balance of this New Testament canon with these 27 writings that begin with the biography, the life of Jesus. That's where you have to begin if you're telling the story of Christianity, with Jesus. The book of Acts become the bridge to get us to the letters. We then have these 14 letters identified with Paul that focus on faith and faith alone and dealing with other matters as well. Seven letters to churches. Seven other documents, but including Hebrews 14. And then these seven letters called the Catholic letters. Have I even said what they are yet? That would be James, 1st and 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and Jude. Seven. Now we're ready for our last book. What's the last book of the canon? The book of Revelation, the only apocalyptic writing in the New Testament collection. And what? Where does it begin? With seven letters to seven churches. And it just, there's such perfect balance to the way God inspired these writings and the way he guided the piecing together of these 27. And I think we ought to pay more attention to it. I think it matters. And, you know, I'm a Luke guy. My firstborn child is Luke. My dissertation was on Luke Acts. I like Luke hyphen Acts. I think it's a great way to read. We should read Luke Acts together. I think they flow together beautifully. But the truth is, you never have Luke and Acts together in any manuscript that we know from early Christianity. It's the four Gospels together. And then Acts attached to the four Gospels. So that you don't have to read Luke and Acts, you can read John and Acts. And Acts tells the story after John. Acts tells the story after Mark. Acts tells the story after Matthew. Acts is the bridge between the four Gospels, not just Luke, but the four Gospels and the letters. And then once you get to the letters, you've got this perfect balance of Paul's letters to seven churches, 14 in his collection. Then the seven Catholic epistles, which are written to more general audiences with more of a focus on how we ought to live as people of faith, living obediently as people of faith. And then we get to the book of Revelation, which opens with the letters to the seven churches again. It's just, there's something beautiful about that balance. And unfortunately, I don't think we take time to think through those things very much. So that's why you got a whole page almost on the letters of John and how they fit into the canon. So that's big view. That's stepping back, broad view. Now let's hone in a little bit on these letters. So authorship and date, you will notice that all three of these letters, as well as the gospel according to John, We attribute it to John, but the gospel itself, the fourth gospel, is anonymous. It nowhere says John wrote it. Now, there is a beloved disciple mentioned in John who says who wrote these things, but the text itself never tells you the beloved disciple is John. We're just piecing things together and going by early church tradition that was John, inner circle, the apostle, you know, one of the first two disciples, James and John. Fisherman. So that's been the tradition that he's responsible for five documents, really: the Gospel of John, these three letters, and the book of Revelation. But these letters and the fourth gospel are technically, they're anonymous. They don't claim authorship. But very early on, John is attached. I was about to break ground tonight by arguing James wrote John. But if you look in this section, authorship and date, I quote Irenaeus, who dies in 202 AD. So we quote people like this because they're a whole lot closer to the authorship than we are. And he's drawing upon earlier sources that John, the disciple of the Lord, who leaned back on Jesus' breast, remember at the supper, published the gospel while he was a resident at Ephesus in Asia. And then in the same section in his work against heresy, he adds a little bit later, "For this reason also he's talking about John, has thus testified to us in his epistle, little children, it is the last time, and as you've heard, Antichrist doth come." So here is a very early source saying that John, inner circle of Jesus' disciples, one of the first of Jesus, of the 12, brother of James, he's responsible for the gospel and for this epistle that he quotes, which is 1 John. And if whoever you say wrote 1 John, you're going to say wrote 2 and 3 John. They just go together naturally. So that's the early church's tradition about that. And you find it's hard to find anybody, any evangelical, who would raise any question about that whatsoever. But I will add that there's been a lot of debate going all the way back to nearly this early, but Eusebius, early church historian who's writing in the 4th century, he quotes Papias. Now that gets you back, and Papias apparently has sources that supposedly go back to even John, Polycarp. So you've got a pretty good historical line there. And I give you what Eusebius says. It's also here, because I didn't think you'd have it handy on your shelf at home, most of you. But it starts about halfway through that authorship and date section, where I say the early church historian Eusebius quotes a statement supposedly from Papias, Bishop of Hierapolis, that. Here it is. "If ever anyone came who'd followed the elders, I inquired into the words of the elders, what Andrew or Peter or Philip or Thomas or James or John or Matthew or any other of the Lord's disciples." Now that looks like he's talking there about the guy I've been describing, the John whose inner circle of Jesus' followers, you can name him with Andrew, Peter, Philip, Thomas, James, John. And he calls him here the Lord's disciples. "What they'd said, and what Aristion and the elder John, the Lord's disciples, were saying." Now, do you see the interesting thing there? You got two Johns mentioned, or the same John mentioned twice, but he's called disciple in one and elder in the second reference, the elder John. So Eusebius, early church historian, interpreted Papias to mean there were two Johns. One, the follower of Jesus, inner circle, James and John, two of the first disciples. The other, the elder John, who wrote, who would have written 2nd and 3rd John for sure, likely the book of Revelation. But the first John he mentioned, the disciple, wrote the Gospel of John and 1 John. So that was the early church historian who posited that there were two Johns. One, the disciple, the inner circle, the other, the elder, who was a different John, and suggested that, you know, they might have written, break up then these five into between these two authors. Hardly anybody thinks Eusebius was right about what that statement was intended to mean. Most modern folks say that he was just referring to the same person using both the designation disciple and elder. So that's where you get a lot of the debate about, is there two different, and one John the Apostle and one John the Elder? I'm going to suggest that they're the same person, and that John, the inner circle, elder, apostle, disciple, are all terms refer to the same John as responsible for all, well, the gospel, three letters, and Revelation. But no, they are technically anonymous. But that's kind of the debate that goes on there. The recipients, I think they're Christians living in and around Ephesus near the end of the first century. Assuming this John that we're talking about is the author, we usually attribute the book of Revelation to him around 95, 96. and that would put these letters likely between the early to mid-90s. But we're at the end of the first century, in and around Ephesus. Now, 2 John's addressed to the elect lady and her children, and 3 John's addressed to somebody named Gaius. And I think the elect lady is a way to refer to the church. The word for church in Greek, ekklesia, is a feminine word. So if you were going to call the church by a pronoun in the first century, in a Greek world, you would have called it a she, her. And to but anything could be a her, but the elect lady, that's a beautiful way to refer to the church. And so I think he's referring to some church in and around Ephesus where they're having problems with these false teachers. And then 3 John, to Gaius, who I would take as the pastor of a church somewhere in and around Ephesus, that he writes a third letter to. Now, why does he write these documents? He's addressing a problem that is internal. There is this false teaching that has penetrated the church, and it has caused division to the point that some have seceded from the church. And you'll see in the notes there, I talk about the secessionists. If you can think of a better term, I'll go with that, because that was hard to say. But people who have seceded from the church, they've left the church. People who were part of the church, but they've left the church. Now, they didn't leave because they didn't like that they, you know, bought a new van for the youth group, or they didn't like the color of the carpet or the ordering of the services, or it wasn't that. It was a theological issue. And it becomes clear from reading the letter what was the heart of the problem. There are some that were denying that Jesus had come truly in the flesh. That was the essence of, I think, what they were suggesting. And he refers to them as antichrists. How about that? He's not very nice when he talks about these false teachers. They are from the devil. They're like their brother, Cain, who killed his brother. So if you look at chapter 2, a couple of texts here. 2:19 is an important one, I think, to get kind of what's going on here. He says, they went out from us because they were not of us. Can you understand the uncertainty of losing members from the congregation over a theological issue? The kinds of problems, if your Sunday school teacher left because he held a very different theological position than you held, and lots of other people were following them to a new church start. If it's somebody you really had confidence in, or you really trusted, or somebody who'd been a mentor to you, or somebody who had discipled you, that can cause an enormous amount of uncertainty. Why did they leave? Are they right? Should I join them? Because what becomes clear is they're not just happy to walk away. They're trying to get other people to join their movement, as is often the case. And so he's trying to explain why they left. They went out from us because they were not of us. If they had been of us truly, they wouldn't have gone out from us. So they're the secessionists, right? So you'll know who I'm talking about the rest of the week if I say the secessionists. He calls them antichrist. Look at just the verse before that. Little children, it is the last hour. And just as you heard that antichrist is coming, even now, many antichrists have come. Now, whatever you view, whatever comes into your head when I say antichrist, I'm going to really urge you to sort of, don't forget everything you know about antichrist, but just sort of put all that on hold, and we're going to look at every text in the New Testament that refers to antichrist. Because it's only in 1 John and once in 2 John. Now you were thinking, well, it's got to be in the book of Revelation. No, there's no antichrist mentioned in the book of Revelation. Now, there's a figure that might be antichrist, you know, 666, but it doesn't call antichrist antichrist. That word's not used in the book of Revelation. It's only in the letters of John, and it's not in 3 John. It's 1 and 2 John. So let's make sure whatever our sort of our image of what Antichrist is and who Antichrist is, it fits with what the text says. And here's what he says: even now many Antichrists have gone out, from whence we know it's the last hour. Then look down at verse 22. Who is the liar except the one that denies that Jesus is the Christ? This is the Antichrist, the one that denies the Father and the Son. So I know this won't tickle anybody's sort of eschatological itch, but you want to know who the Antichrist is? The one who denies the Father and the Son. That's who Antichrist is. And I'm going to tell you, we've built this almost this figure that as the opponent of the church, the Antichrist, and boy, if we just knew who that was. And the greater threat to the church is this Antichrist that denies the Father and the Son, or that denies that Jesus has come in the flesh. That's what we should really be afraid of. False teaching about Jesus among the people of God. Jesus is going to take care of this man of lawlessness with the breath of his mouth. He's not a threat to God's people. The threat to the church is not some figure out there. The gravest threat to the church is false teaching about the nature of Jesus. That's the thing we've got to stay alert to. So he's telling you here, this is the Antichrist, the one that denies the Father and the Son. Then look at chapter 4, verse 3. And every spirit which does not confess Jesus is not of God. That's a pretty solid principle, don't you say? And this is the spirit of Antichrist, which you have heard that he is coming, and even now is already in the world. And then the last one is in 2 John, verse 7. Many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not confess Jesus Christ having come in the flesh. This is the deceiver and the Antichrist. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have now read every passage in the New Testament that makes a reference to Antichrist. And you have to stop and think through. Now, what do I think about Antichrist, and why do I think that? And we need to keep coming back to the biblical text. And I'm not denying a figure that shows up when we get to the very end of the last hour. I'm not denying that. I'm saying, don't worry about that figure. If you got that Antichrist itch, you know, sort of that pin the tail on the Antichrist, trying to figure out who, and the church has been trying this for 2,000 years, and they were certain that it was the Roman Emperor, and then they were certain that it was the Pope and the Reformation period, and then they were certain that it was Osama bin Laden, and then they were certain that it was Bill Clinton, and sometimes the Pope still gets votes today for that, and you know, Ronald Reagan. I mean, I don't want to blow your mind here tonight, but Ronald Wilson Reagan, if you spell that out, six letters for Ronald, six letters for Wilson, six letters for Reagan. 666. Come on now. Now that's what you came here looking for tonight, that kind of. No, of course not. Of course not. But, you know, depending on how strong a Democrat you are, I might be able to get you on board with that. Oh, I bet I could get you on board with somebody else tonight if you're a strong enough Democrat. But I'm not going there, I promise you. But this is how he refers to the false teachers in the churches in and around Ephesus. They're the Antichrist because they deny the Father and the Son. They reject that Jesus has come in the flesh. They are rejecting an essential aspect of Jesus' nature, that he is fully human. They're not denying that he's fully God, that he is God. There's no hint that they've got any problem with Jesus as God. It's Jesus as fully human. And that's as grave a heresy as denying Jesus' deity, if you deny his genuine humanity. Think of what we lose if we somehow think he's just, well, he was kind of a man or partially a man, or he was only a man at certain points of his ministry, we lose everything. There's a great story Irenaeus tells about, now I don't know if this really happened, but it gives you some insight into how this thinking was out there. But there was a heretic named Cerinthus. Now, he was supposed to be a Gnostic, one of these people who thought the world was divided into matter and spirit and good and evil, and all matter was evil. So, and I've been in a bathhouse in Ephesus that they excavated. It's where you went to go to the bathroom. Don't think the worst of a bathhouse in ancient. It's just this place you go to the bathroom. Public, just hole after hole, side by side. So the story Irenaeus tells is John, our apostle, goes into the bathhouse at Ephesus and sees that Cerinthus is in there. And he runs from the building because he's afraid, because the heretic Cerinthus is there, it's going to collapse on them. Now, I don't think this is directed at Cerinthus, but Cerinthus thought that Jesus became God at his baptism, and then somehow the deity left him at the crucifixion, so only the human Jesus died. So he only became God at his baptism, and then the deity left him at his death. That was the heart of Cerinthus' thinking. Now, he thought a lot of other things too that were wrong, that were bad theology. But doesn't that sound like the kind of thinking that John's addressing here? Now, that's too specific for me. I wouldn't say he's writing against Cerinthus, but it lets you know there are people out there that were thinking things like that. And what's the heart of that? It's questioning the genuine humanity of Jesus. And I think this letter is trying to address that. And that's Antichrist, to deny that. So that's the problem. So he addresses it in 1 John. Well, then what 2 and 3 John tell us? When you get to 2 John, it's addressed to the elect lady and her children. And what does he say to her? He says, please, I want you to receive the teachers that I'm sending to you into your home and show them hospitality. Now let's think about the story that's working behind these letters. There's a false teaching that invades the church in and around Ephesus. I've described what I think is the heart of it. It's caused a split in the church there. John's writing to try to address it. Does 1 John bring an end to the problem? No. In fact, John needs to continue to send teachers out to the churches. Ephesus was a large city. There wouldn't have just been a building where the Christians at Ephesus met. They would have been spread out in house churches all over the place. So he's sending out teachers in and around Ephesus to go teach the truth, to help other churches that might be struggling to know what is true about Jesus and the things about which they could be certain about him and about the eternal life that is theirs. Where are those people going to stay? Holiday Inn? Motel 6, we'll leave the light on for you, something like that. No, you had to depend upon the hospitality of people in the community to which you were going to visit. He's urging the elect lady and her children, which I would take as the church and the members of the church, to receive these authoritative teachers in because they need to hear from them. And he's saying to them, do not even give a greeting to these secessionists, to these people carrying this false teaching. What's that tell you about the false teachers? They're out there trying to recruit people to their way of thinking. And so he writes 2 John to say, don't even receive them into your home. And if you do, if you give them a foothold in your community, you'll be responsible for whatever evil they do. That's 2 John. 3 John writes it to a man named Gaius. He's happy with Gaius. Gaius is doing fine. He's receiving the teachers that are being sent out. But there's another guy there. His name's Diotrephes. And he wants to be first. And John says, I'm going to come, and when I come, I'm going to deal with him. I'm going to answer all the lies that he's been telling about us. And besides that, He's not receiving the teachers. So here's somebody who's challenging the authority of Gaius, who might be some, you know, trying to take control of the church, and he doesn't want to receive any teachers. And John's not happy at all. But can you see there's a story in the running here, and these three letters are addressing that story that's running in the background, and it's about false teaching and false teachers and the danger they are to the church, but the certainty that you can have in who Jesus is and the eternal life that we find in Him. It's the kind of certainty they needed in a very uncertain time. And I'm pretty confident it's the kind of certainty we can still use in our own day.